He had gotten the wind knocked out of himself, too. 3 or 4 days later, his daddy had been stomping around, telling Mommy furiously that he had been all over the goddamn basement, and the trunk wasn't there, and he was going to sue the goddamn movers who had left it somewhere between Vermont and Colorado. How was he supposed to be able to finish the play if things like this kept cropping up? Danny said, "No, Daddy, it's under the stairs. The movers put it right under the stairs." Daddy had given him a strange look and had gone down to see. The trunk had been there, just where Tony had shown him. Daddy had taken him aside, had sat him on his lap, and had asked Danny who let him down cellar. Had it been Tom from upstairs? The cellar was dangerous, Daddy said. That was why the landlord kept it locked. If someone was leaving it unlocked, Daddy wanted to know. He was glad to have his papers and his play, but it wouldn't be worth it to him, he said, if Danny fell down the stairs and broke his leg. Danny told his father earnestly that he hadn't been down in the cellar. That door was always locked, and Mommy agreed. Danny never went down in the back hall, she said, because it was damp and dark and spidery, and he didn't tell lies. "Then how did you know, Doc?" Daddy asked. "Tony showed me." His mother and father had exchanged a look over his head. This had happened before, from time to time. Because it was frightening, they swept it quickly from their minds. But he knew they worried about Tony, Mommy especially, and he was careful about thinking the way that could make Tony come where she might see. But now he thought she was lying down, not moving about in the kitchen yet, and so he concentrated hard to see if he could understand what Daddy was thinking about. His brow furrowed, and his slightly grimy hands clenched into tight fists on his jeans. He did not close his eyes, that wasn't necessary, but he squinched them down to slits and imagined Daddy's voice, Jack's voice, John Daniel Torrance's voice, deep and steady, sometimes quirking up with amusement or deepening even more with anger, or just staying steady because he was thinking. Thinking of, thinking about, thinking, thinking. Danny sighed quietly, and his body slumped on the curb as if all the muscles had gone out of it. He was fully conscious. He saw the street and the girl and boy walking up the sidewalk on the other side, holding hands because they were in love, so happy about the day and themselves together in the day. He saw autumn leaves blowing along the gutter, yellow cartwheels of irregular shape. He saw the house they were passing and noticed how the roof was covered with shingles. "I guess it'll be no problem if the flashing's okay. Yeah, that'll be all right. That Watson, Christ, what a character. Wish there was a place for him in the play. I'll end up with the whole fucking human race in it if I don't watch out. Yeah. Shingles. Are there nails out there? Oh, shit, forgot to ask him. Well, they're simple to get. Sidewinder hardware store. Wasps. They're nesting this time of year. I might want to get one of those bug bombs in case they're there when I rip up the old shingles. New shingles. Old shingles." So that's what he was thinking about. He had gotten a job and was thinking about shingles. Danny didn't know who Watson was, but everything else seemed clear enough. And he might get to see a wasp's nest, just as sure as his name was Danny. Danny. He looked up, and there was Tony, far up the street, standing by a stop sign and waving. Danny, as always, felt a warm burst of pleasure at seeing his old friend. But this time he seemed to feel a prick of fear, too, as if Tony had come with some darkness hidden behind his back, a jar of wasps which when released would sting deeply. But there was no question of not going. He slumped further down on the curb, his hands sliding laxly from his thighs and dangling below the fork of his crotch. His chin sank onto his chest. Then there was a dim, painless tug as part of him got up and ran after Tony into funneling darkness. "Danny." Now the darkness was shot with swirling whiteness, a coughing, whooping sound, and bending, tortured shadows that resolved themselves into fir trees at night being pushed by a screaming gale. Snow swirled and danced, snow everywhere. "Too deep," Tony said from the darkness, and there was a sadness in his voice that terrified Danny. "Too deep to get out." Another shape, looming, rearing, huge and rectangular, a sloping roof, whiteness that was blurred in the stormy darkness, many windows, a long building with a shingled roof. Some of the shingles were greener, newer. His daddy put them on, with nails from the Sidewinder hardware store. Now the snow was covering the shingles. It was covering everything. A green witch light glowed into being on the front of the building, flickered, and became a giant, grinning skull over two crossed bones. "Poison," Tony said from the floating darkness. "Poison." Other signs flickered past his eyes, some in green letters, some of them on boards stuck at leaning angles into the snowdrifts. "No swimming. Danger. Live wires. This property condemned. High voltage. Third rail. Danger of death. Keep off. Keep out. No trespassing. Violators will be shot on sight." He understood none of them completely. He couldn't read, but got a sense of all. And a dreamy terror floated into the dark hollows of his body, like light brown spores that would die in sunlight. They faded. Now he was in a room filled with strange furniture, a room that was dark. Snow spattered against the windows like thrown sand. His mouth was dry, his eyes like hot marbles, his heart trip-hammering in his chest. Outside there was a hollow, booming noise like a dreadful door being thrown wide. Footfalls. Across the room was a mirror, and deep down in its silver bubble, a single word appeared in green fire, and that word was Red Rum. The room faded. Another room. He knew, would know, this one. An overturned chair. A broken window with snow swirling in. Already it had frosted the edge of the rug. The drapes had been pulled free and hung on their broken rod at an angle. A low cabinet lying on his face. More hollow booming noises, steady, rhythmic, horrible. Smashing glass, approaching destruction. A hoarse voice, the voice of a madman, made the more terrible by its familiarity.
"Come out! Come out, you little shit! Take your medicine!"
Crash, 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 splintering wood, a bellow of rage and satisfaction. Red Rum. Coming. Drifting across the room, pictures torn off the walls. A record player, Mommy's record player, overturned on the floor. Her records, Grieg, Handel, The Beatles, Art Garfunkel, Bach, Liszt, thrown everywhere. Broken into jagged black pie wedges. A shaft of light coming from another room, the bathroom, harsh white light, and a word flickering on and off in the medicine cabinet mirror like a red eye. Red Rum. Red Rum. Red Rum.
"No," he whispered. "No, Tony, please."
And dangling over the white porcelain lip of the bathtub, a hand. Limp. A slow trickle of blood, Red Rum, trickling down one of the fingers, the third dripping onto the tile from the carefully shaped nail.
"No, oh no, oh no. Oh please, Tony, you're scaring me."
Red Rum, Red Rum, Red Rum.
"Stop it, Tony, stop it."
Fading. In the darkness, the booming noises grew louder, louder still, echoing everywhere, all around. And now he was crouched in a dark hallway, crouched on a blue rug with a riot of twisting black shapes woven into its pile, listening to the booming noises approach, and now a shape turned the corner and began to come toward him, lurching, smelling of blood and doom. It had a mallet in one hand, and it was swinging it, Red Rum, from side to side in vicious arcs, slamming it into the walls, cutting the silk wallpaper and knocking out ghostly bursts of plaster dust.
"Come on and take your medicine. Take it like a man."
The shape advancing on him, reeking of that sweet-sour odor, gigantic, the mallet head cutting across the air with a wicked, hissing whisper, then the great hollow boom as it crashed into the wall, sending the dust out in a puff you could smell, dry and itchy. Tiny red eyes glowed in the dark. The monster was upon him. It had discovered him, cowering here with a blank wall at his back, and the trapdoor in the ceiling was locked. Darkness. Drifting.
"Tony, please take me back. Please. Please."
And he was back, sitting on the curb of Arapaho Street, his shirt sticking damply to his back, his body bathed in sweat. In his ears he could still hear that huge contrapuntal booming sound and smell his own urine as he voided himself in the extremity of his terror. He could see that limp hand dangling over the edge of the tub with blood running down one finger, the third, and that inexplicable word so much more horrible than any of the others, Red Rum. And now, sunshine. Real things. Except for Tony, now six blocks up, only a speck, standing on the corner, his voice faint and high and sweet.
"Be careful, Doc."
Then in the next instant, Tony was gone. And Daddy's battered red bug was turning the corner and chattering up the street, farting blue smoke behind it. Danny was off the curb in a second, waving, jiving from one foot to the other, yelling, "Daddy! Hey, Dad! Hi! Hi!" His daddy swung the VW into the curb, killed the engine, and opened the door. Danny ran toward him and then froze, his eyes widening. His heart crawled up into the middle of his throat and froze solid. Beside his daddy, in the other front seat, was a short-handled mallet, its head clotted with blood and hair. Then it was just a bag of groceries. "Danny, you okay, Doc?"
"Yeah, I'm okay."
He went to his daddy and buried his face in daddy's sheepskin-lined denim jacket and hugged him tight, tight, tight. Jack hugged him back, slightly bewildered. "Hey, you don't want to sit in the sun like that, Doc. You're dripping sweat."
"I guess I fell asleep a little. I love you, Daddy. I've been waiting."
"I love you too, Dan. I brought home some stuff. Think you're big enough to carry it upstairs?"
"Sure am."
"Doc Torrance, the world's strongest man," Jack said, and ruffled his hair, "whose hobby is falling asleep on street corners." Then they were walking up to the door, and Mommy had come down to the porch to meet them, and he stood on the second step and watched them kiss. They were glad to see each other. Love came out of them the way love had come out of the boy and girl walking up the street and holding hands. Danny was glad. The bag of groceries, just a bag of groceries, crackled in his arms. Everything was all right. Daddy was home. Mommy was loving him. There were no bad things. And not everything Tony showed him always happened. But fear had settled around his heart, deep and dreadful, around his heart and around that indecipherable word he had seen in his spirit's mirror. 5. Phone booth. Jack parked the VW in front of the Rexall in the Table Mesa shopping center and let the engine die. He wondered again if he shouldn't go ahead and get the fuel pump replaced, and told himself again that they couldn't afford it. If the little car could keep running until November, it could retire with full honors anyway. By November, the snow up there in the mountains would be higher than the Beetle's roof, maybe higher than three Beetles stacked on top of each other. "Want you to stay in this car, Doc. I'll bring you a candy bar."
"Why can't I come in?"
"I have to make a phone call. It's private stuff."
"Is that why you didn't make it at home?"
"Check." Wendy had insisted on a phone in spite of their unraveling finances. She had argued that with a small child, especially a boy like Danny, who sometimes suffered from fainting spells, they couldn't afford not to have one. So Jack had forked over the $30 installation fee, bad enough, and a $90 security deposit, which really hurt. And so far the phone had been mute, except for two wrong numbers.
"Can I have a baby Ruth, Daddy?"
"Yes. You sit still and don't play with the gear shift, right?"
"Right. I'll look at the maps."
"You do that." As Jack got out, Danny opened the Bugs glove box and took out the five battered gas station maps. Colorado, Nebraska, Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico. He loved road maps, loved to trace where the roads went with his finger. As far as he was concerned, new maps were the best part of moving west. Jack went to the drugstore counter, got Danny's candy bar, a newspaper, and a copy of the October Writer's Digest. He gave the girl a five and asked for his change in quarters. With the silver in his hand, he walked over to the telephone booth by the key-making machine and slipped inside. From here he could see Danny and the bug through three sets of glass. The boy's head was bent studiously over his maps. Jack felt a wave of nearly desperate love for the boy. The emotion showed on his face as a stony grimness. He supposed he could have made his obligatory thank-you call to Al from home. He certainly wasn't going to say anything Wendy would object to. It was his pride that said no. These days he almost always listened to what his pride told him to do, because along with his wife and son, $600 in a checking account, and one weary 1968 Volkswagen, his pride was all that was left. The only thing that was his. Even the checking account was joint. A year ago he had been teaching English in one of the finest prep schools in New England. There had been friends, although not exactly the same ones he'd had before going on the wagon. Some laughs, fellow faculty members who admired his deft touch in the classroom and his private dedication to writing. Things had been very good 6 months ago. All at once there was enough money left over at the end of each two-week pay period to start a little savings account. In his drinking days, there had never been a penny left over, even though Al Shockley had stood a great many of the rounds. He and Wendy had begun to talk cautiously about finding a house and making a down payment in a year or so. A farmhouse in the country. Take 6 or 8 years to renovate it completely. What the hell, they were young. They had time. Then he had lost his temper. George Hatfield. The smell of hope had turned to the smell of old leather in Cromart's office. The whole thing like some scene from his own play. The old prints of previous Stovington headmasters on the walls, steel engravings of the school as it had been in 1879 when it was first built, and in 1895, when Vanderbilt money had enabled them to build the field house that still stood at the west end of the soccer field, squat, immense, dressed in ivy. April ivy had been rustling outside Cromart's slit window, and the drowsy sound of steam heat came from the radiator. It was no set, he remembered thinking. It was real. His life. How could he have fucked it up so badly?
This is a serious situation, Jack. Terribly serious. The board has asked me to convey its decision to you.
The board wanted Jack's resignation, and Jack had given it to them. Under different circumstances, he would have gotten tenure that June. What had followed that interview in Cromart's office had been the darkest, most dreadful night of his life. The wanting, the needing to get drunk had never been so bad. His hand shook. He knocked things over. And he kept wanting to take it out on Wendy and Danny. His temper was like a vicious animal on a frayed leash. He had left the house, in terror that he might strike them. Had ended up outside a bar, and the only thing that had kept him from going in was the knowledge that if he did, Wendy would leave him at last, and take Danny with her. He would be dead from the day they left. Instead of going into the bar where dark shadows sat sampling the tasty waters of oblivion, he had gone to Al Shockley's house. The board's vote had been 6-1. Al had been the one. Now he dialed the operator, and she told him that for $1.85 he could be put in touch with Al 2,000 miles away for 3 minutes. Time is relative, baby, he thought, and stuck in 8 quarters. Faintly he could hear the electronic boops and beeps of his connection sniffing its way eastward. Al's father had been Arthur Longley Shockley, the steel baron. He had left his only son, Albert, a fortune, and a huge range of investments and directorships and chairs on various boards. One of these had been on the board of directors for Stovington Preparatory Academy, the old man's favorite charity. Both Arthur and Albert Shockley were alumni, and Al lived in Barrie, close enough to take a personal interest in the school's affairs. For several years, Al had been Stovington's tennis coach. Jack and Al had become friends in a completely natural and uncoincidental way. At the many school and faculty functions they attended together, they were always the two drunkest people there. Shockley was separated from his wife, and Jack's own marriage was skidding slowly downhill, although he still loved Wendy and had promised sincerely and frequently to reform, for her sake and for baby Danny's. The two of them went on from many faculty parties, hitting the bars until they closed, then stopping at some mom-and-pop store for a case of beer they would drink parked at the end of some back road. There were mornings when Jack would stumble into their leased house with dawn seeping into the sky and find Wendy and the baby asleep on the couch, Danny always on the inside, a tiny fist curled under the shelf of Wendy's jaw. He would look at them and the self-loathing would back up in his throat in a bitter wave, even stronger than the taste of beer and cigarettes and martinis. Martians, as Al called them. Those were the times that his mind would turn thoughtfully and sanely to the gun, or the rope, or the razor blade. If the bender had occurred on a weeknight, he would sleep for 3 hours, get up, dress, chew 4 Excedrins, and go off to teach his 9 o'clock American poets, still drunk. Good morning, kids. Today the red-eyed wonder is going to tell you about how Longfellow lost his wife in the big fire. He hadn't believed he was an alcoholic, Jack thought, as Al's telephone began ringing in his ear. The classes he had missed or taught unshaven, still reeking of last night's Martians. Not me. I can stop any time. The nights he and Wendy had passed in separate beds. Listen, I'm fine. Mashed fenders. Sure, I'm okay to drive. The tears she always shed in the bathroom. Cautious looks from his colleagues at any party where alcohol was served, even wine. the slowly dawning realization that he was being talked about, the knowledge that he was producing nothing at his Underwood but balls of mostly blank paper that ended up in the wastebasket. He had been something of a catch for Stovington, a slowly blooming American writer, perhaps, and certainly a man well qualified to teach that great mystery, creative writing. He had published 2 dozen short stories. He was working on a play, and thought there might be a novel incubating in some mental back room. But now he was not producing, and his teaching had become erratic. It had finally ended one night less than a month after Jack had broken his son's arm. That, it seemed to him, had ended his marriage. All that remained was for Wendy to gather her will. If her mother hadn't been such a grade-A bitch, he knew, Wendy would have taken a bus back to New Hampshire as soon as Danny had been okay to travel. It was over. It had been a little past midnight. Jack and Al were coming into Barrie on U.S. 31, Al behind the wheel of his Jag, shifting fancily on the curves, sometimes crossing the double yellow line. They were both very drunk. The Martians had landed that night in force. They came around the last curve before the bridge at 70, and there was a kid's bike in the road, and then the sharp, hurt squealing as rubber shredded from the Jag's tires, and Jack remembered seeing Al's face looming over the steering wheel like a round, white moon. Then the jingling, crashing sound as they hit the bike at 40, and it had flown up like a bent and twisted bird, the handlebars striking the windshield, and then it was in the air again, leaving the starred safety glass in front of Jack's bulging eyes. A moment later he heard the final dreadful smash as it landed on the road behind them. Something thumped underneath them as the tires passed over it. The Jag drifted around broadside, Al still jockeying the wheel, and from far away Jack heard himself saying, "Jesus, Al! We ran him down, I felt it!" In his ear, the phone kept ringing. "Come on, Al, be home. Let me get this over with." Al had brought the car to a smoking halt, not more than 3 feet from a bridge stanchion. 2 of the Jag's tires were flat. They had left zigzagging loops of burned rubber for 130 feet. They looked at each other for a moment, and then ran back in the cold darkness. The bike was completely ruined. One wheel was gone, and looking back over his shoulder, Al had seen it lying in the middle of the road, 6 spokes sticking up like piano wire. Al had said hesitantly, "I think that's what we ran over, Jackie boy." "Then where's the kid?" "Did you see a kid?" Jack frowned. It had all happened with such crazy speed. Coming around the corner, the bike looming in the Jag's headlights, Al yelling something, then the collision and the long skid. They moved the bike to one shoulder of the road. Al went back to the Jag and put on its 4-way flashers. For the next 2 hours, they searched the sides of the road, using a powerful 4-cell flashlight. Nothing. Although it was late, several cars passed the beached Jaguar and the 2 men with the bobbing flashlight. None of them stopped. Jack thought later that some queer providence, bent on giving them both a last chance, had kept the cops away, had kept any of the passers-by from calling them. At 2:15 they returned to the Jag, sober but queasy.
"If there was nobody riding it, what was it doing in the middle of the road?" Al demanded. "It wasn't parked on the side, it was right in the fucking middle."
Jack could only shake his head. "Your party does not answer," the operator said. "Would you like me to keep on trying?" "A couple more rings, operator. Do you mind?" "No, sir," the voice said dutifully. "Come on, Al." Al had hiked across the bridge to the nearest payphone, called a bachelor friend and told him it would be worth $50 if the friend would get the Jag snow tires out of the garage and bring them down to the Highway 31 bridge outside of Barrie. The friend showed up 20 minutes later, wearing a pair of jeans and his pajama top. He surveyed the scene.
"Kill anybody?"
he asked. Al was already jacking up the back of the car, and Jack was loosening lug nuts.
"Providentially, no one," Al said.
"I think I'll just head on back anyway. Pay me in the morning."
"Fine,"
Al said without looking up. The 2 of them had gotten the tires on without incident, and together they drove back to Al Shockley's house. Al put the Jag in the garage and killed the motor. In the dark quiet, he said,
"I'm off drinking, Jackie boy. It's all over. I've slain my last Martian."
And now, sweating in this phone booth, it occurred to Jack that he had never doubted Al's ability to carry through. He had driven back to his own house in the VW, with the radio turned up, and some disco group chanted over and over again, Talismanic in the house before dawn. Do it anyway. You want to do it. Do it any way you want. No matter how loud, he heard the squealing tires, the crash. When he blinked his eyes shut, he saw that single crushed wheel with its broken spokes pointing at the sky. When he got in, Wendy was asleep on the couch. He looked in Danny's room and Danny was in his crib on his back, sleeping deeply, his arms still buried in the cast. In the softly filtered glow from the streetlight outside, he could see the dark lines on its plastered whiteness where all the doctors and nurses and pediatrics had signed it. It was an accident. He fell down the stairs. Oh, you dirty liar. It was an accident. I lost my temper. You fucking drunken waste. God wiped snot out of his nose and that was you. Listen, hey, come on, please, just an accident. But the last plea was driven away by the image of that bobbing flashlight as they hunted through the dry late November weeds, looking for the sprawled body that by all good rights should have been there, waiting for the police. It didn't matter that Al had been driving. There had been other nights when he had been driving. He pulled the covers up over Danny, went into their bedroom, and took the Spanish Llama 38 down from the top shelf of the closet. It was in a shoebox. He sat on the bed with it for nearly an hour, looking at it, fascinated by its deadly shine. It was dawn when he put it back in the box and put the box back in the closet. That morning he had called Bruckner, the department head, and told him to please post his classes. He had the flu. Bruckner agreed, with less good grace than was common. Jack Torrance had been extremely susceptible to the flu in the last year. Wendy made him scrambled eggs and coffee. They ate in silence. The only sound came from the backyard, where Danny was gleefully running his trucks across the sand pile with his good hand. She went to do the dishes. Her back to him, she said, Jack, I've been thinking.
Have you?
He lit a cigarette with trembling hands. No hangover this morning, oddly enough. Only the shakes. He blinked. In the instant's darkness, the bike flew up against the windshield, starring the glass. The tires shrieked. The flashlight bobbed.
I want to talk to you about what's best for me and Danny.
For you too, maybe. I don't know. We should have talked about it before, I guess. Would you do something for me? He asked, looking at the wavering tip of a cigarette. Would you do me a favor? What? Her voice was dull and neutral. He looked at her back. Let's talk about it a week from today, if you still want to. Now she turned to him, her hands lacy with suds, her pretty face pale and disillusioned.
Jack, promises don't work with you. You just go right on with—
She stopped, looking in his eyes, fascinated, suddenly uncertain. In a week, he said. His voice had lost all its strength and dropped to a whisper.
Please. I'm not promising anything. If you still want to talk, then we'll talk about anything you want.
They looked across the sunny kitchen at each other for a long time, and when she turned back to the dishes without saying anything more, he began to shudder.
God, he needed a drink. Just a little pick-me-up to put things in their true perspective.
Danny said he dreamed you had a car accident, she said abruptly. He has funny dreams sometimes. He said it this morning when I got him dressed.
Did you, Jack? Did you have an accident?
No. By noon, the craving for a drink had become a low-grade fever. He went to Al's.
You dry?
Al asked before letting him in. Al looked horrible.
Bone dry. You look like Lon Chaney in Phantom of the Opera. Come on in.
They played two-handed whist all afternoon. They didn't drink. A week passed. He and Wendy didn't speak much, but he knew she was watching, not believing. He drank coffee black and endless cans of Coca-Cola. One night he drank a whole six-pack of Coke and then ran into the bathroom and vomited it up. The level of the bottles in the liquor cabinet did not go down. After his classes, he went over to Al Shockley's. She hated Al Shockley worse than she had ever hated anyone. And when he came home, she would swear she smelled scotch or gin on his breath, but he would talk lucidly to her before supper, drink coffee, play with Danny after supper, sharing a Coke with him, read him a bedtime story, then sit and correct themes with cup after cup of black coffee by his hand. and she would have to admit to herself that she had been wrong. Weeks passed, and the unspoken word retreated further from the back of her lips. Jack sensed its retirement, but knew it would never retire completely. Things began to get a little easier. Then, George Hatfield. He had lost his temper again, this time stone sober.
"Sir, your party still doesn't—"
"Hello?" Al's voice, out of breath.
"Go ahead," the operator said dourly.
"Al, this is Jack Torrance."
"Jackie boy."
Genuine pleasure.
"How are you?"
"Good. I just called to say thanks. I got the job. It's perfect. If I can't finish that goddamn place snowed in all winter, I'll never finish it."
"You'll finish."
"How are things?" Jack asked hesitantly.
"Dry,"
Al responded.
"You?"
"As a bone."
"Miss it much?"
"Every day." Al laughed.
"I know that scene. But I don't know how you stayed dry after that Hatfield thing, Jack. That was above and beyond."
"I really bitched things up for myself," he said evenly.
"Oh, hell. I'll have the board around by spring. Effinger's already saying they might have been too hasty. And if that play comes to something—"
"Yes. Listen, my boy's out in the car, Al. He looks like he might be getting restless."
"Sure. Understand.
You have a good winter up there, Jack. Glad to help."
"Thanks again, Al."
He hung up, closed his eyes in the hot booth, and again saw the crashing bike, the bobbing flashlight. There had been a squib in the paper the next day, no more than a space filler, really, but the owner had not been named. Why it had been out there in the night would always be a mystery to them, and perhaps that was as it should be. He went back out to the car and gave Danny his slightly melted baby Ruth.
"Daddy?"
"What, Doc?" Danny hesitated, looking at his father's abstracted face.
"When I was waiting for you to come back from that hotel, I had a bad dream, do you remember, when I fell asleep?"
"Mm-hmm." But it was no good. Daddy's mind was someplace else, not with him, thinking about the bad thing again.
"I dreamed that you hurt me, Daddy."
"What was the dream, Doc?"
"Nothing,"
Danny said as they pulled out into the parking lot. He put the maps back into the glove compartment.
"You sure?"
"Yes."
Jack gave his son a faint, troubled glance, and then his mind turned to his play. 6. Night Thoughts. Love was over, and her man was sleeping beside her. Her man. She smiled a little in the darkness, his seed still trickling with slow warmth from between her slightly parted thighs, and her smile was both rueful and pleased, because the phrase, her man, summoned up 100 feelings. Each feeling examined alone was a bewilderment. Together, in this darkness floating to sleep, they were like a distant blues tune heard in an almost deserted nightclub, melancholy but pleasing. "Loving you, baby, is just like rolling off a log. But if I can't be your woman, I sure ain't gonna be your dog." Had that been Billie Holiday? Or someone more prosaic like Peggy Lee? Didn't matter. It was low and torchy, and in the silence of her head it played mellowly, as if issuing from one of those old-fashioned jukeboxes, a Wurlitzer perhaps, half an hour before closing. Now, moving away from her consciousness, she wondered how many beds she had slept in with this man beside her. They had met in college, and had first made love in his apartment. That had been less than 3 months after her mother drove her from the house, told her never to come back, that if she wanted to go somewhere she could go to her father, since she had been responsible for the divorce. That had been in 1970. So long ago. A semester later they had moved in together, had found jobs for the summer, and had kept the apartment when their senior year began. She remembered that bed the most clearly, a big double that sagged in the middle. When they made love, the rusty box spring had counted the beats. That fall she had finally managed to break from her mother. Jack had helped her. "She wants to keep beating you," Jack had said. "The more times you phone her, the more times you crawl back begging forgiveness, the more she can beat you with your father. It's good for her, Wendy, because she can go on making believe it was your fault. But it's not good for you." They had talked it over again and again in that bed that year. Jack sitting up with the covers pulled around his waist, a cigarette burning between his fingers, looking her in the eye. He had a half-humorous, half-scowling way of doing that, telling her, "She told you never to come back, right?" never to darken her door again, right? Then why doesn't she hang up the phone when she knows it's you? Why does she only tell you that you can't come in if I'm with you? Because she thinks I might cramp her style a little bit. She wants to keep putting the thumbscrews right to you, baby. You're a fool if you keep letting her do it. She told you never to come back, so why don't you take her at her word? Give it a rest. And at last, she'd seen it his way. It had been Jack's idea to separate for a while, to get perspective on the relationship, he said. She had been afraid he had become interested in someone else. Later she found it wasn't so. They were together again in the spring, and he asked her if she had been to see her father. She had jumped, as if he'd struck her with a quirt.
How did you know that?
The shadow knows. Have you been spying on me? And his impatient laughter, which had always made her feel so awkward, as if she were 8 and he was able to see her motivations more clearly than she. You needed time, Wendy.
For what?
I guess to see which one of us you wanted to marry.
Jack, what are you saying?
I think I'm proposing marriage. The wedding. Her father had been there, her mother had not been. She discovered she could live with that, if she had Jack. Then Danny had come, her fine son. That had been the best year, the best bed. After Danny was born, Jack had gotten her a job typing for 6 English department profs. Quizzes, exams, class syllabi, study notes, reading lists. She ended up typing a novel for one of them, a novel that never got published, much to Jack's very irreverent and very private glee. The job was good for 40 a week, and skyrocketed all the way up to 60 during the 2 months she spent typing the unsuccessful novel. They had their first car, a 5-year-old Buick with a baby seat in the middle. Bright, upwardly mobile young marrieds. Danny forced a reconciliation between her and her mother, a reconciliation that was always tense and never happy, but a reconciliation all the same. When she took Danny to the house, she went without Jack. And she didn't tell Jack that her mother always remade Danny's diapers, frowned over his formula, could always spot the accusatory first signs of a rash on the baby's bottom or privates. Her mother never said anything overtly, but the message came through anyway. The price she had begun to pay, and maybe always would, for the reconciliation, was the feeling that she was an inadequate mother. It was her mother's way of keeping the thumbscrews handy. During the days, Wendy would stay home and housewife, feeding Danny his bottles in the sun-washed kitchen of the 4-room, second-story apartment, playing her records on the battered, portable stereo she had had since high school. Jack would come home at 3, or at 2 if he felt he could cut his last class, and while Danny slept he would lead her into the bedroom, and fears of inadequacy would be erased. At night, while she typed, he would do his writing and his assignments. In those days, she sometimes came out of the bedroom where the typewriter was to find both of them asleep on the studio couch, Jack wearing nothing but his underpants, Danny sprawled comfortably on her husband's chest with his thumb in his mouth. She would put Danny in his crib, then read whatever Jack had written that night before waking him up enough to come to bed. The best bed, the best year. Sun gonna shine in my backyard someday. In those days, Jack's drinking had still been well in hand. On Saturday nights, a bunch of his fellow students would drop over, and there would be a case of beer and discussions in which she seldom took part because her field had been sociology and his was English. Arguments over whether Pepys' diaries were literature or history. Discussions of Charles Olson's poetry. Sometimes the reading of works in progress. Those and 100 others. No, 1,000. She felt no real urge to take part. It was enough to sit in her rocking chair beside Jack, who sat cross-legged on the floor, one hand holding a beer, the other gently cupping her calf or braceleting her ankle. The competition at UNH had been fierce, and Jack carried an extra burden in his writing. He put in at least an hour at it every night. It was his routine. The Saturday sessions were necessary therapy. They let something out of him that might otherwise have swelled and swelled until he burst. At the end of his grad work, he had landed the job at Stovington, mostly on the strength of his stories, 4 of them published at that time, one of them in Esquire. She remembered that day clearly enough. It would take more than 3 years to forget it. She had almost thrown the envelope away, thinking it was a subscription offer. Opening it, she had found instead that it was a letter saying that Esquire would like to use Jack's story, Concerning the Black Holes, early the following year. They would pay $900, not on publication, but on acceptance. That was nearly half a year's take typing papers, and she had flown to the telephone, leaving Danny in his high chair to goggle comically after her, his face lathered with creamed peas and beef puree. Jack had arrived from the university 45 minutes later, the Buick weighted down with 7 friends and a keg of beer. After a ceremonial toast, Wendy also had a glass, although she ordinarily had no taste for beer. Jack had signed the acceptance letter, put it in the return envelope, and went down the block to drop it in the letterbox. When he came back, he stood gravely in the door and said, "Veni, vidi, vici." There were cheers and applause. When the keg was empty at 11 that night, Jack and the only 2 others who were still ambulatory went on to hit a few bars. She had gotten him aside in the downstairs hallway. The other 2 were already out in the car, drunkenly singing the New Hampshire fight song. Jack was down on 1 knee, owlishly fumbling with the lacings of his moccasins. "Jack," she said, "you shouldn't. You can't even tie your shoes, let alone drive." He stood up and put his hands calmly on her shoulders.
"Tonight I could fly to the moon if I wanted to."
"No," she said, "not for all the Esquire stories in the world. I'll be home early." But he hadn't been home until 4 in the morning, stumbling and mumbling his way up the stairs, waking Danny up when he came in. He had tried to soothe the baby and dropped him on the floor. Wendy had rushed out, thinking of what her mother would think if she saw the bruise before she thought of anything else. God help her, God help them both. And then picked Danny up, sat in the rocking chair with him, soothed him. She had been thinking of her mother for most of the 5 hours Jack had been gone, her mother's prophecy that Jack would never come to anything. "Big ideas," her mother had said. "Sure, the welfare lines are full of educated fools with big ideas." Did the Esquire story make her mother wrong or right? "Winifred, you're not holding that baby right. Give him to me." And was she not holding her husband right? Why else would he take his joy out of the house? A helpless kind of terror had risen up in her, and it never occurred to her that he had gone out for reasons that had nothing to do with her.
"Congratulations," she said, rocking Danny. He was almost asleep again. "Maybe you gave him a concussion."
"It's just a bruise." He sounded sulky, wanting to be repentant, a little boy. For an instant she hated him.
"Maybe," she said tightly, "maybe not."
She heard so much of her mother talking to her departed father in her own voice that she was sickened and afraid.
"Like mother, like daughter," Jack muttered.
"Go to bed,"
she cried, her fear coming out sounding like anger.
"Go to bed, you're drunk."
"Don't tell me what to do."
"Jack, please, we shouldn't—"
There were no words.
"Don't tell me what to do," he repeated sullenly, and then went into the bedroom.
She was left alone in the rocking chair with Danny, who was sleeping again. 5 minutes later, Jack's snores came floating out to the living room. That had been the first night she had slept on the couch. Now she turned restlessly on the bed, already dozing. Her mind, freed of any linear order by encroaching sleep, floated past the first year at Stovington, past the steadily worsening times that had reached low ebb when her husband had broken Danny's arm, to that morning in the breakfast nook. Danny outside playing trucks in the sand pile, his arm still in the cast. Jack sitting at the table, pallid and grizzled, a cigarette jittering between his fingers. She had decided to ask him for a divorce. She had pondered the question from 100 different angles, had been pondering it, in fact, for the 6 months before the broken arm. She told herself she would have made the decision long ago if it hadn't been for Danny, but not even that was necessarily true. She dreamed on the long nights when Jack was out, and her dreams were always of her mother's face and of her own wedding. "Who giveth this woman?" Her father standing in his best suit, which was none too good. He was a traveling salesman for a line of canned goods that even then was going broke. And his tired face. How old he looked. How pale.
"I do."
Even after the accident, if you could call it an accident, she had not been able to bring it all the way out, to admit that her marriage was a lopsided defeat. She had waited, dumbly hoping that a miracle would occur and Jack would see what was happening, not only to him but to her. But there had been no slowdown. A drink before going off to the academy, 2 or 3 beers with lunch at the Stovington house, 3 or 4 martinis before dinner, 5 or 6 more while grading papers. The weekends were worse. The nights out with Al Shockley were worse still. She had never dreamed there could be so much pain in a life when there was nothing physically wrong. She hurt all the time. How much of it was her fault? That question haunted her. She felt like her mother, like her father. Sometimes when she felt like herself, she wondered what it would be like for Danny, and she dreaded the day when he grew old enough to lay blame. And she wondered where they would go. She had no doubt her mother would take her in, and no doubt that after a year of watching her diapers remade, Danny's meals recooked and/or redistributed, of coming home to find his clothes changed or his hair cut or the books her mother found unsuitable, spirited away to some limbo in the attic. After half a year of that, she would have a complete nervous breakdown, and her mother would pat her hand and say comfortingly, "Although it's not your fault, it's all your own fault. You were never ready. You showed your true colors when you came between your father and me. My father, Danny's father, mine, his. Who giveth this woman? I do." Dead of a heart attack 6 months later. The night before that morning she had lain awake almost until he came in, thinking, coming to her decision. The divorce was necessary, she told herself. Her mother and father didn't belong in the decision. Neither did her feelings of guilt over their marriage, nor her feelings of inadequacy over her own. It was necessary for her son's sake, and for herself, if she was to salvage anything at all from her early adulthood. The handwriting on the wall was brutal, but clear. Her husband was a lush. He had a bad temper, one he could no longer keep wholly under control now that he was drinking so heavily and his writing was going so badly. Accidentally or not accidentally, he had broken Danny's arm. He was going to lose his job, if not this year, then the year after. Already she had noticed the sympathetic looks from the other faculty wives. She told herself that she had stuck with the messy job of her marriage for as long as she could. Now she would have to leave it. Jack could have full visitation rights, and she would want support from him only until she could find something and get on her feet. And that would have to be fairly rapidly because she didn't know how long Jack would be able to pay support money. She would do it with as little bitterness as possible. But it had to end. So thinking, she had fallen off into her own thin and unrestful sleep, haunted by the faces of her own mother and father. "You're nothing but a home wrecker," her mother said. "Who giveth this woman?" the minister said. "I do," her father said. But in the bright and sunny morning, she felt the same. Her back to him, her hands plunged in warm dishwater up to the wrists, she had commenced with the unpleasantness. "I want to talk to you about something that might be best for Danny and I. For you, too, maybe. We should have talked about it before, I guess." And then he had said an odd thing. She had expected to discover his anger, to provoke the bitterness, the recriminations. She had expected a mad dash for the liquor cabinet. But not this soft, almost toneless reply that was so unlike him. It was almost as though the Jack she had lived with for 6 years had never come back last night, as if he had been replaced by some unearthly doppelganger that she would never know or be quite sure of. "Would you do something for me? A favor?" "What?" She had to discipline her voice strictly to keep it from trembling. "Let's talk about it in a week, if you still want to." And she had agreed. It remained unspoken between them. During that week he had seen Al Shockley more than ever, but he came home early, and there was no liquor on his breath. She imagined she smelled it, but knew it wasn't so. Another week. And another. Divorce went back to committee, unvoted on. What had happened? She still wondered, and still had not the slightest idea. The subject was taboo between them. He was like a man who had leaned around a corner, and had seen an unexpected monster lying in wait, crouching among the dried bones of its old kills. The liquor remained in the cabinet, but he didn't touch it. She had considered throwing them out a dozen times, but in the end always backed away from the idea, as if some unknown charm would be broken by the act. And there was Danny's part in it to consider. If she felt she didn't know her husband, then she was in awe of her child. Awe in the strict meaning of that word, a kind of undefined, superstitious dread. Dozing lightly, the image of the instant of his birth was presented to her. She was again lying on the delivery table, bathed in sweat, her hair in strings, her feet splayed out in the stirrups, and a little high from the gas they kept giving her whiffs of. At one point she had muttered that she felt like an advertisement for gang rape, and the nurse, an old bird who had assisted at the births of enough children to populate a high school, found that extremely funny. The doctor between her legs, the nurse off to one side, arranging instruments and humming. The sharp, glassy pains had been coming at steadily shortening intervals, and several times she had screamed in spite of her shame. Then the doctor told her quite sternly that she must push, and she did. And then she felt something being taken from her. It was a clear and distinct feeling, one she would never forget, the thing taken. Then the doctor held her son up by the legs. She had seen his tiny sex and known he was a boy immediately. And as the doctor groped for the air mask, she had seen something else, something so horrible that she found the strength to scream again, after she had thought all screams were used up. He has no face. But of course there had been a face, Danny's own sweet face, and the call that had covered it at birth now resided in a small jar which she had kept, almost shamefully. She did not hold with old superstition, but she had kept the call nevertheless. She did not hold with wives' tales, but the boy had been unusual from the first. She did not believe in second sight, but, did Daddy have an accident? I dreamed Daddy had an accident. Something had changed him. She didn't believe it was just her getting ready to ask for a divorce that had done it. Something had happened before that morning. Something that had happened while she slept uneasily. Al Shockley said that nothing had happened, nothing at all, but he had averted his eyes when he said it. And if you believed faculty gossip, Al had also climbed aboard the fabled wagon. Did Daddy have an accident? Maybe a chance collision with fate, surely nothing much more concrete. She had read that day's paper and the next day's with a closer eye than usual, but she saw nothing she could connect with Jack. God help her, she had been looking for a hit-and-run accident, or a barroom brawl that had resulted in serious injuries, or who knew, who wanted to. But no policeman came to call, either to ask questions or with a warrant empowering him to take paint scrapings from the VW's bumpers. Nothing. Only her husband's 180-degree change and her son's sleepy question on waking. Did Daddy have an accident? I dreamed. She had stuck with Jack more for Danny's sake than she would admit in her waking hours, but now, sleeping lightly, she could admit it. Danny had been Jack's for the asking, almost from the first. Just as she had been her father's, almost from the first. She couldn't remember Danny ever spitting a bottle back on Jack's shirt. Jack could get him to eat after she had given up in disgust, even when Danny was teething and it gave him visible pain to chew. When Danny had a stomach ache, she would rock him for an hour before he began to quiet. Jack had only to pick him up, walk twice around the room with him, and Danny would be asleep on Jack's shoulder, his thumb securely corked in his mouth. He hadn't minded changing diapers, even those he called the special deliveries. He sat with Danny for hours on end, bouncing him on his lap, playing finger games with him, making faces at him while Danny poked at his nose and then collapsed with the giggles. He made formulas and administered them faultlessly, getting up every last burp afterward. He would take Danny with him in the car to get the paper, or a bottle of milk, or nails at the hardware store, even when their son was still an infant. He had taken Danny to a Stovington Keen soccer match when Danny was only 6 months old, and Danny had sat motionlessly on his father's lap through the whole game, wrapped in a blanket, a small Stovington pennant clutched in one chubby fist. He loved his mother, but he was his father's boy. And hadn't she felt, time and time again, her son's wordless opposition to the whole idea of divorce? She would be thinking about it in the kitchen, turning it over in her mind as she turned the potatoes for supper over in her hands for the peeler's blade. And she would turn around to see him sitting cross-legged in a kitchen chair, looking at her with eyes that seemed both frightened and accusatory. Walking with him in the park, he would suddenly seize both her hands and say, almost demand, "Do you love me? Do you love Daddy?" And confused, she would nod or say, "Of course I do, honey." Then he would run to the duck pond, sending them squawking and scared to the other end, flapping their wings in a panic before the small ferocity of his charge, leaving her to stare after him and wonder. There were even times when it seemed that her determination to at least discuss the matter with Jack dissolved, not out of her own weakness, but under the determination of her son's will. I don't believe such things. But in sleep she did believe them. And in sleep, with her husband's seed still drying on her thighs, she felt that the three of them had been permanently welded together. That if their three-oneness was to be destroyed, it would not be destroyed by any of them, but from outside. Most of what she believed centered around her love for Jack. She had never stopped loving him, except maybe for that dark period immediately following Danny's accident. And she loved her son. Most of all, she loved them together, walking or riding or only sitting. Jack's large head and Danny's small one, poised alertly over the fans of old maid hands, sharing a bottle of Coke, looking at the funnies. She loved having them with her, and she hoped to dear God that this hotel caretaking job Al had gotten for Jack would be the beginning of good times again. And the wind gonna rise up, baby, and blow my blues away. Soft and sweet and mellow, the song came back and lingered, following her down into a deeper sleep, where thought ceased, and the faces that came in dreams went unremembered. 7. In another bedroom. Danny awoke with the booming still loud in his ears, and the drunk, savagely pettish voice crying hoarsely,
"Come out here and take your medicine. I'll find you. I'll find you."
But now the booming was only his racing heart, and the only voice in the night was the faraway sound of a police siren. He lay in bed motionlessly, looking up at the wind-stirred shadows of the leaves on his bedroom ceiling. They twined sinuously together, making shapes like the vines and creepers in a jungle, like patterns woven into the nap of a thick carpet. He was clad in Dr. Denton pajamas, but between the pajama suit and his skin, he had grown a more closely fitting singlet of perspiration. "Tony?" he whispered. "You there?" No answer. He slipped out of bed and padded silently across to the window and looked out on Arapaho Street, now still and silent. It was 2 in the morning. There was nothing out there but empty sidewalks drifted with fallen leaves, parked cars, and the long-necked streetlight on the corner across from the Cliff Bryce gas station. With its hooded top and motionless stance, the streetlight looked like a monster in a space show. He looked up the street both ways, straining his eyes for Tony's slight, beckoning form. But there was no one there. The wind sighed through the trees, and the fallen leaves rattled up the deserted walks and around the hubcaps of parked cars. It was a faint and sorrowful sound, and the boy thought that he might be the only one in Boulder awake enough to hear it, the only human being, at least. There was no way of knowing what else might be out in the night, slinking hungrily through the shadows, watching and scenting the breeze.
"I'll find you. I'll find you."
"Tony?" he whispered again, but without much hope. Only the wind spoke back, gusting more strongly this time, scattering leaves across the sloping roof below his window. Some of them slipped into the rain gutter and came to rest there like tired dancers. "Danny. Danny." He started at the sound of that familiar voice and craned out the window, his small hands on the sill. With the sound of Tony's voice, the whole night seemed to have come silently and secretly alive, whispering even when the wind quieted again and the leaves were still and the shadows had stopped moving. He thought he saw a darker shadow standing by the bus stop a block down, but it was hard to tell if it was a real thing or an eye trick. "Don't go, Danny." Then the wind gusted again, making him squint, and the shadow by the bus stop was gone, if it had ever been there at all. He stood by his window for a minute, an hour, sometime longer, but there was no more. At last he crept back into his bed and pulled the blankets up and watched the shadows thrown by the alien streetlight turn into a sinuous jungle filled with flesh-eating plants that wanted only to slip around him, squeeze the life out of him, and drag him down into a blackness where one sinister word flashed in red. Red rum. Part 2. Closing Day. 8. A View of the Overlook. Mommy was worried, She was afraid the bug wouldn't make it up and down all these mountains, and that they would get stranded by the side of the road where somebody might come ripping along and hit them.